So I think I'll just let him talk and tell us what he's all about and cross our fingers that the technology holds up. So, Greg, over to you.
Okay, Joe. Hi, everybody, and hi, Joe. Thanks for the introduction, and I love that you said that we disagreed and had verbal battles. My shorthand for myself these days is that my subject is the future of classical music, and on that, sometimes it's even hard to know what questions to ask, so of course we disagree. It's a sign of our vitality, Joe, and makes me all the more happy to talk to you rather than somebody who would be so embarrassed by that. Anyhow, I'm really honored to be here talking to you. You are, according to the list Joe gave me, a really impressive and distinguished group. I'm sure some of you know more about the subject than I do. I'm especially honored to be invited by the LSO because you all, Joe, have been such a leader in so many aspects of this. Most recently, at least in my understanding, with your digital conference, which was tweeted in progress. Yesterday, I read the tweets. I was endlessly impressed. I wouldn't have understood that an entire conference could be so well rendered in 140 character tweets. And in fact,
Took a lot of typing.
Well, I'm sure. Did you do it?
Me and Gavin Wave.
Yeah. Hi, Gavin. Well, hard work, but so well worth it, and thanks to both of you. I'm actually going to end my remarks by just diving into a few things that were said in those tweets. One thing I should say before I forget, that my big endeavor these days is writing a book on the future of classical music, which I'm going to unfold things about bit by bit online, and anybody interested can find out on my blog, or I can email you about it, but we'll let that go. I just had to get that in. A little self-promotion. So, and one other thing. I discovered as I went through my notes that a lot of the references I make are to things in the UK, and the reasons for that, besides, of course, that's where you were, but it really happened by accident. Every August, my wife and I spend in the Yorkshire Dales, so I pick things up from the British press. Secondly, I'm friends with Peter Gregson, who some of you may know, who is just an outstanding person in the UK dealing with digital things in music. And then some of it is, I guess, pure coincidence, or maybe the great stuff is going on in the UK. So all of us are trying to do something involved with technology. And what is that exactly? Are we, for example, learning the best use of a whole bright toolbox of new shiny tools? Or are we learning to thrive in a new and different kind of world? These things in some ways are very different, but I want to suggest that they are actually in some ways the same. And I'm going to do that with a story from the US. It was something I read about in the New York Times a few days ago. Seems that many colleges and universities in the US are flaunting, in fact, student blogs on their websites. Now, you understand that in the US, many colleges and universities, the majority are private, and they compete for students. So one of the ways they compete nowadays is by flaunting the students' blogs, which often are critical of the institutions. The reason they do this is that they find that students trying to decide where to go to school are not interested in the official messages from the college and the official websites in how the colleges describe themselves. They want to know what it's really like to be there, and they think they can best find that out from students who are already there. So now you have a controversy. Some colleges, like MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, one of our leading schools, actually pays some students to blog, knowing they'll be critical. Other colleges don't want to have anything to do with this because they think, oh my God, it's going to undermine our message. The students are going to say bad things. But the students seem to be voting to say, this is what we want to make up our minds. So, in the newspaper, should this be slugged, as we say in the journalistic business, a technology story? Or should we classify it as a culture story? I would say that it's obviously a little bit of both, but what I would say most of all is that these things are combined, that they become the same thing because new technologies spawn a new culture, which is maybe the most obvious thought in the world, but I don't think it can be said enough. So in this case, we have the internet and the ability we all have to, once we find each other, communicate instantly. And we also have, thanks to Google, for example, the ability to find ourselves immediately. And so a lot of things begin to change. If I want to buy a product, for example, and I'm sure many of you do this, again, most obvious thing in the world, you know, I'm going to read the advertisements and the specs for it on the company's website, but then I'm going to find out what people think, what people who use it think. And that's going to be play a big part in how I make up my mind. So, we can all now find people who know things that we want to know, go directly to them, communicate them, form our own opinion, and, most interestingly, somebody who buys a product has equal access to the internet with a company, much larger of course, that makes it. We can't stop this. The question, I think, for the use of technology is how to join it, help it along, for example, enable people interested in you to find out about you from the inside and communicate with each other, and then use it to help you, to help all of us. And by the way, I'm mounting an online marketing campaign for my book, so I'm in the middle of this, just as you may be. One of the interesting examples of this is what happens when corporations get on Twitter. They discover that a lot of people are complaining about them, saying bad things. So what do? They don't throw up their hands in horror. Many of them monitor the complaints and immediately communicate with the person complaining. I had this happen to me this very summer in the UK. I was having a little trouble, I thought, with my car rental, and I tweeted that I was having trouble with the company. And within a couple of hours, I had an answer from corporate headquarters and from the branch that I had rented the car from. A way to put it is from Marcus Davy, who runs the Roundhouse in London, whom I know a little because I met his parents this summer, terrific people. He wrote in something for the Arts Council in Britain, "In the past few years, our society has changed quite considerably from one where people consume to one where people participate, take part in the action, and where they are not just spectators happy to observe. We have at our disposal for the first time the ability to have mass creative and artistic collaboration. The internet, and in particular sites such as YouTube, have shown that something new is possible, and through them we have seen a great surge of creativity, of people sharing, producing work with a great feeling of freedom to allow others to take part as well, which is something I think that's very difficult for people in classical music to know what to do with, because if you have increasingly people who are creating things themselves and want to create and maybe want to take part in your own creative process, how do we reconcile that with the great tradition of classical music and our sense, which is both true and sometimes I think a little bit patronizing, that we know far better than newcomers to the field what is what and what the newcomers should know about?" Well, one consequence of this new world is that you cannot just use technology to do the same things as the old technology. I believe this firmly. And Twitter is a really good example. That is, if you use Twitter just to send out microscopic little press releases, you're really not using it to its full effect. I'll say more about that later. But what I always say to people is that when you're embarking on a tech project, and I say this to friends in the business, and then I say it when I'm hired as a consultant, you have to ask yourself what you want to accomplish. What is the point of it? And then, if you start down a particular tech road, what new opportunities is it going to offer you that you might not have thought of before? An example of how I've done this, I was doing a consultancy for an excellent small choral group in a mid-sized American city, and they knew they needed a new website, and they certainly needed a new website. And I kept telling them, don't make it right away. It was so tempting to them. Find some wonderful graphics student who can design a website for you cheaply, have a beautiful thing. And I kept saying to them, ask yourself what you want to accomplish with it, and also figure out how you're going to get people to go to it, because that's actually harder than designing the site itself. And once you've answered those questions, including the one about how you're going to get people to go to it, then you will know better what you want to have it for and what it should look like and what should be on it. So Twitter is like that. Many people, I think, as individuals and organizations, are deciding they want to be on Twitter because everybody's on Twitter, because Twitter is the flavor of the month or the season of the year. So then what do you do with it? So many classical music organizations that I follow send out press releases. And they'd send them out anyway. So now they see, oh, Twitter, new way to reach people with my press releases. So now 140 words from the New York Philharmonic. Alan Gilbert will conduct Mahler's Immortal Third Symphony tonight with an exclamation point added, which I take to be a well-meaning but utterly feeble way to somehow pretend that this is interesting and exciting to many people. And I grant you that for those who follow the New York Philharmonic and are intensely interested and maybe don't have other sources of information, this may be great news. But the opportunity missed is to make yourself really personable and interesting and to people even who may never go to your concerts, which may benefit you tremendously in your city. And it also may make people go to the concerts. A friend of mine in the States found this out in the most wonderful way. His name is Jim McCarthy. He runs a company called Gold Star, which is an immense success. It resells tickets to spectator events ranging from big-time sports events to opera performances and symphony concerts. If some seats remain unsold, he has a subscription list. He'll sell them to them half price. So he was faithfully Twittering things about which concerts were available. And he was then one day getting the tires on his car replaced. He was really annoyed. It was taking too long. He didn't think they were doing a good job. So in exasperation, he tweeted about that and got the biggest response he had ever gotten from any tweet the company had ever sent. And he suddenly discovered, his realization was that the people receiving his tweets were not just interested in the company, they were interested in the people behind it. They wanted to know who was who, and they loved finding out this thing about them, which then made them more loyal and interesting to the company. One organization I think that does this very well is the BBC Music Magazine, whose tweets are just lively and personable and interesting. As an example of how far behind we can get, I'm going to take a company in the US called 21C, who some of you may know, a big marketing and publicity firm that is wanting to become a new media company. They sent out a tweet that I feel, and I have friends in the company, so apologies to them, called High Tech Hampson, about Thomas Hampson, one of their clients, which I thought was embarrassment right from the title, partly because tech people don't say high tech these days. Immediately they showed they're not in touch with technology. Should have said tech savvy. It's a tiny thing, but it really is indicative. But then the things they were blogging about, that he has a new iPhone app, that his recital program will be downloadable for the first recital he gives on a tour this year, and you can then go buy it and keep it. It will be streamed on the internet and be available intermittently during his tour, divided into segments with commentary from him. I'm not going to say that this is a bad thing. It sounds like an excellent promotional plan, but they were claiming that this was a cutting-edge use of technology, not just in the classical music world, but for anywhere. And there I have to say, no, I don't think so. I might, giving you some quick examples, talk about the 2009 Wigmore Hall Cohn Foundation International Song Competition, where they streamed the finals, and then they had people watching could join the discussion of who was better and argue with the jury. And meanwhile, they had correspondents tweeting and taking photographs behind the scenes, interviewing the singers, accompanists, judging panel, and audience members. I can think of what Peter Gregson told me he did with the Proms this summer, charged by them to create some kind of content on their website that would really interest younger people. He himself went behind the scenes, and just as in the Wigmore Hall competition, which in fact Peter told me about, he interviewed people, put the interviews up on the site. He put a page where people could comment on the concerts and the interviews, got a lot of traffic on that. And he said that, seems hard to believe, but Peter's an honest guy. He said that the percentage of younger people at the proms increased steadily through the summer, which he thinks is partly due to that. Peter himself has done very stimulating concerts, where, as some of you may know, he's a cellist, and a terrific one. He plays a cello concert in a room equipped for media, and people tweet and text their reaction as he's playing. It's displayed on a screen, and they get into discussions with each other about his playing and about the music while he's playing it. A pianist in the United States, Hugh Sung, has done something he calls Clair de Lune from scratch, where he is teaching the famous Debussy piano piece online with video instruction going one measure at a time, aiming this at people who play by ear as well as people who know music, daily 5 to 9 minute video lessons, responding to feedback from participants via YouTube's comments and video response. I like that. But then my star example is Imogen Heap, a singer-songwriter who released a new album called Ellipse this summer while I was in the UK, and I read the piece about it, not a review, but an advance piece about it in The Independent. So they described first what she did in her previous album. She announced she was going to write and produce an album and would regularly update fans on its progress through her blog, and she did, and the first two tracks were premiered online. Well, that was nothing. For the new album, she did all the songs on her laptop and recorded them in a writing trip that took her around the world. During the 2 years it took her to do this, she made 40 video blogs entries that are shown on YouTube to keep her fans updated, and asked the fans to contribute ideas. Through her MySpace site, she was in contact with 350,000 fans. And when Twitter came along, she immediately got on Twitter. She now has 750,000 people following her on Twitter. But she asked her fans to contribute videos that they made themselves to her press biography for the album. They had to submit the entries via Twitter, and anybody whose entry was used would receive a signed copy of the album. 81 fans ended up contributing. She asked fans to contribute to the album artwork based on the lyrics, which she posted online. More than 1,000 fans responded, and 11 of them had content that was included in the final package. That, to me, is a terrific use of technology. Actually, I know some pop people who raise funds for their album beforehand online. That is, they're going to make an album. The money is all raised in advance. People buy the album in advance or make large contributions, especially useful in an age when record companies are increasingly only recording people they feel are guaranteed successful, which leaves out a lot of interesting artists. But this business of fans can contribute, ordinary people can contribute to the stuff that credentialed artists are doing, this is maybe the heart of what's going on now. I feel that we may be in, musically certainly, the most creative age I've ever seen and or heard about. And my own book, I have to say, is being influenced by people who read the initial stuff I've put up about it. I'll just give you one example. I put up on my blog a skeletal outline, just saying a sentence or two about what was going to be in each chapter. I had 3 chapters designed to prove that classical music institutions as we know them now, I'm talking mainly about the US, so your mileage, as we say, may differ, are in long-term trouble because of the shrinking of their audience, the aging of their audience, and the difficulty they have, which will increase, I believe, in raising funds. I got most interesting feedback from people who run major American orchestras and from just people who read my blog, whom I don't know much about, saying this was too well known and I didn't need to devote three chapters to it. I'm still up in the air about that. I'm fascinated that it's people who run major orchestras, some of the biggest in America, who think that's such a familiar fact that we don't need to talk about it. But I'm also fascinated. I also get in a lot of arguments about it, so I think maybe I should say it. But I learned from this reaction, because what they were saying to me is, don't bog down in that. Give your visions of the future and say how we're going to get there. So I decided I needed to front load the book with that. That whatever I did about proving or not proving the state we're in now, I needed to front load the book with inspiration and ideas about what the future would look like. So thank you to my fans and readers and opponents. I expect to hear a lot more about them. So let me now go to some points from the LSO Digital Conference, which I read on Twitter. Somebody tweeted, where does the responsibility for digital live in an arts organization? Marketing? Technology? Education? Should it be across the whole organization? My answer to that, and you know, this is just me adding my voice to the stream, and I can be completely wrong, but I think, and you know why I say that? It just struck me. If I had read that somewhere, I would probably say, okay, this is the truth. But because it was a participatory thing on Twitter and so many voices were being heard, now I feel a little bit more modest about it and I say this is just my voice. So there's a way that the culture is influencing me directly right now. So where does the responsibility for digital live in an arts organization? I say if it's a new culture, then it cannot just be a project carried out by one department. The whole organization has in some way to be involved, if only because the ramifications of anything that are going to be done are going to reach the whole organization. I have a scary story, actually, about no less distinguished an organization than the New York Philharmonic. A couple of years ago, Lauren Mazel decided to do a concert performance of Tosca as part of their season. And it was decided that the orchestra should put online a video that would introduce listeners to Tosca. Putting videos online was not a priority of the Philharmonic, and they didn't have a department dedicated to this. So it fell, as I found out later, to the lot of somebody with an important job doing other things to get this video done. So he doesn't have too much time for that, and he doesn't have a background in video production. So no fault of his, no blame to anybody. The organization is not set up for this. So they found somebody who did part-time work for the organization who said he would produce the video, and what they got, you may find this hard to believe, but it really happened, was an amateur video of an amateur soprano singing Vici d'Arte with a pianist who didn't understand the key signature and played wrong notes throughout on the New York Philharmonic's website. They then were just savaged by this on opera blogs, and by the time I got around to look at it, it came off. Okay, I happen to know the person who was unfortunately responsible for this, who was just rather devastated by what he had created. And so he got then a professional radio producer to produce something that was only audio, and he asked me to listen to it. And the guy in reciting the plot of Tosca didn't know what it was and had made mistakes. This is the New York Philharmonic. It's interesting that the Metropolitan Opera hired as its head of communications, responsible for marketing and publicity and everything online, a radio producer. I think they figured the marketing and publicity they knew and she could supervise that, but online digital content, that they didn't know. So they should get somebody in one of the top positions of the company who was a specialist in it. Okay, another tweet. Best quote from the conference. We have to be careful not to take things too far before we understand how tech will ultimately be used. Okay, I understand the caution there, and I have certainly been in a lot of discussions, public panels, private discussions, in which people really worry about this. You know, how do we know what we're doing? But my answer is, number one, none of us know how tech is ultimately going to be used. We really don't know where this is going. And so the idea that we'd better be cautious in starting anything because we don't know the ultimate goal of it, I think that's hopeless, because we're never going to know the ultimate goal. And in fact, the only way the goal is going to be found, the only way we're ever going to know where this is going, is by all of us individually and as a group, as a community, all of us doing it. Now, that doesn't mean you just plunge in and do any dumb thing that comes into your head. You do have to be careful, but you have to understand that it's probably leading in directions that you can't predict. And that's, I think, actually where you have to be vigilant. You have to be vigilant about unintended consequences, both good and bad. You do something, where is it leading you? What's happening? What did you not expect that's happening? And where could you possibly go with that? But at the same time that you need to be cautious, you also have to just at the same time jump in. It reminds me of a book was read a lot when I was in college, Albert Camus's The Rebel, which is about the philosophy and morality of revolution. And he said, you had to go to the barricades with a gun in your hand and a lump in your throat, though you were probably going to do the wrong thing. I think that's probably true on a much less high-stakes way with our use of digital things. So, somebody on one of the panels, in answer to a question, said, what we should be asking, I've forgotten, I'm sorry what the question is, what we should be asking is whether digital can help us deliver our core mission. And it struck me reading that, that if we really are in the middle of a new and evolving culture, then maybe our core mission is evolving too. Maybe it's going to change, or maybe it's going to be redefined in what could amount to very radical ways. The idea that we have a core mission and that we know what it is might itself be troublesome in a time when things are changing really radically. I just thought of an interesting example for that, which kind of floored me, just amazed me when I ran into it. There's a book published in the US called Engaging Art, edited by some very distinguished people. A collection of essays by prominent people in the arts. And the idea is to deal with the current cultural changes and see what we can learn about them. So one of the essays, the most challenging and stimulating in my view, was about the art actually created by teenagers going to high school. And some of it is just dramatic, and a lot of it is not art as art has traditionally been defined. For example, they talked about a girl who became fascinated with Japanese culture through anime and studied it intensely, studied the Japanese language, and her art was to design and sew clothes for herself, imaginatively taking off from Japanese models and wearing something new every day. Is that art? Apparently, it is in the new climate, and I could give many, many examples about it. What I'm leading up to is something in the book from a professor at Swarthmore College in the US, a very distinguished small school, who said that he was appalled by the amount of creativity in the world, and he thought arts organizations should put a stop to it. I'm not making this up. That there was too much, it was bad, nobody had any control of its quality or its content, and it was the job of arts institutions to squeeze it off so that people couldn't find it. How you would expect to do this in the modern world is completely beyond me. I don't think it's possible. But that's what he thought should happen. And that's, I think, what a danger in an extreme form, granted, of what happens when you're too fixated on your mission. If as an arts organization you think your mission is to bring the very best of things to people, and you know what that is, and you don't want what that is questioned, then you may find yourself opposing the stuff that jumps up spontaneously. It doesn't mean, by the way, that everything that jumps up spontaneously is good. That would be really, really silly to say. But the idea that you could control it, I think that's equally silly, and maybe there's a lot of terrific good in it. Just recently, a CD came out, or actually it's about to come out, a performance of Terry Riley's In C. It's actually two CDs. One is the performance, the other one is remixes of it by a whole variety of interesting people from the classical music world and out. What happens if your performances are remixed by your listeners? That could be really interesting. Okay, just two more. One group discussing social media and who uses it. We need to understand how they use it. Well, yes. But on the other hand, if you're going to sit down as an organization or delegate a committee or a department or even a person to understand how social media are used and then make sure that the whole organization or the proper leading people understand this, if this is what you think you have to do, you have lost the game already, because social media are alive and well, and they're working. So what you need to do is find people who understand that and have them tell you what might be done. You know, you can then, you don't have to do it all, but for the whole organization to come to an understanding of this ongoing and established phenomenon, that seems to me just wrong. It actually defines the organization as one that doesn't know anything about this and needs to learn. Whereas the organization, if it's of any size, is riddled by people, maybe the younger ones, who use social media every day, so just go to them. Once when I was working with the Cleveland Orchestra here on a rather limited project, we discovered that it was supposed to reach people who don't usually pay attention to the orchestra. Turned out many members of their staff were exactly in that position. They never went to concerts. And so by polling them, we got better ideas than we would have by sitting around and just pondering it ourselves. Finally, maybe whimsically on my part, somebody tweeted, I guess it was an idea of how you distribute content and could you do it track by track. He says, you can't watch Hamlet by the track. And I so much beg to differ. Maybe I'm alone in this, but I doubt it. I put movies and TV episodes on my iPhone and I watch them 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes at a time. I've gotten through all kinds of terrific movies, most recently La Dolce Vita, which I hadn't seen since it came out in 1959 or 60, whenever it was, and I watched it 10 minutes at a time. It was fine. And as a matter of fact, since Shakespeare plays are divided into scenes, a scene could be a track, and the play has already told you what its tracks are. So, I disagree with that, and I think it's actually, with all respect to the person who said it, which for all I know is one of you, but no, seriously, it's just not quite comprehending how things are changed and how people, in this case, me, are actually using the new technologies. Well, with that, I peter out. I have no more that I can think of to say, and I would love to hear and learn from any reactions you have. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Greg. Does anyone have any questions for Greg? Gavin has one. I'll just pass the microphone to
you. Hi, Gavin.
Hi, Greg. You've touched on it all already, and it covers classical and I guess wider music industry as well. And then we have these two elements that go together when using content online. On the one hand, we've got this culture now and the advance of technology that's allowing us to interact more and more closely with music, which is great, whether it be downloaded music, whether it be remixing music, mashups and whatnot, and being able to put those online and share them with your community, which is all fantastic. But on the other hand, copyright law at all hasn't changed and isn't really set up or able to enable this process and to allow people to make as much of it as we could. And you touched on it when you said about Imogen's Heaps album, and I wondered, did any of the people there have to sign off their rights? Because effectively, if they have contributed towards the music or the composition or the artwork, will they grant any rights? Is she paying them any money for that? Or is that all paid off? And what do you think about how copyright and the technologies are really at odds and increasingly at odds with each other?
Oh, that's a terrific question, and it's really a big one. I would bet that everybody who contributed to her project had to sign some kind of agreement. Impossible otherwise. Her lawyers would never permit it, and it would be dumb because they might, down the road, claim that they were owed something, especially if the album is a huge success and makes endless amounts of money. So yes, you have to come in and you have to take all those steps. The way that I see copyright laws and the equivalent standing in the way are with streaming and downloading. At one point I teach, you know, at Juilliard in New York, have been for many years, and I am very active doing projects with music schools, one of them with the University of Maryland I'm doing in the next 2 years. We're going to try to develop with some students concerts that will reach people the students' own age, which I think is a direction we should go. But I've suggested to music schools that they should try to make stars of their students. Stream every student recital. Make it available for download afterwards. Stream it by video. Try to develop an audience for it. And the students as entrepreneurs can play a big part in this. And immediately everybody says, oh my God, copyright, streaming rights, which by the way are different for works in the public domain than they are for new pieces. You may be able to stream some things and not others. And then I find out at different schools, different lawyers give different legal opinions. Somebody said, and this was a real killer, it depends what edition of a classic work you're playing. If you're using an edition that's under copyright, a new critical edition, to take the most obvious example, then you can't stream it, allegedly, without permission of the copyright owners. Whereas if you took an out-of-print edition, maybe with mistakes in it, you could do that. So this is something that's being worked out project by project, institution by institution, and it's really, really difficult because the impulse is from the heart, my God, just make this stuff available. And the practice is, may not legally be possible, but the logjam does seem to break. And in the US, one of the most difficult things were orchestras' contracts with musicians, which effectively made recording for commercial purposes totally impossible because of what the musicians had to be paid. And over the last decade, that really has begun to loosen up, so things are being done. And I imagine over time it changes just because everybody understands the opportunities that are there. That is, to protect stream of, let's say, one of my works, so my copyright is protected, maybe it's actually much more in my interest to get it out there. The amount I might hope to make from it is small in any case. Great question, though. One of the wonderful things I've found out about this subject and the future of classical music generally is that people just go and do things and suddenly show a way that nobody expected before. So it's very hard to know how it's going to change. I would predict that somebody somewhere is going to do something dramatic that nobody ever heard of before. I'm going to give you a very, very down-home domestic example. There's a chamber orchestra about 5 years old in Houston, Texas, called the River Oaks Chamber Orchestra, which makes childcare available at all of its concerts. The concerts are given at 5 p.m. People bring their children, put them in the childcare. The children are then taught about one of the pieces on the program and are brought in to hear it. And they're also, they sing a little bit of it for the rest of the audience. And then the child care continues to 11 p.m. so that the parents can then go out for the evening after they've heard the concert and pick up their children. Now, there are various ways that this was financially and otherwise possible. But when I've told that to, let's say, marketing directors at huge orchestras, they turn green with jealousy. Why didn't they think of that, and why can't they do that? So I imagine that happens with online marketing, but I'm probably also waffling here because at the moment I can't think of dramatic examples, Joe, of something new. Have you run into any?
No. Surprise me with the question.
Oh, we all must know them. We all must. I'm sorry, I really should, something should come to mind, and maybe it will in our next few minutes. I want to say one thing, though. There is always a danger of going too far, and I, in my enthusiasm, have sketched out a world in whose implications the standard concert seems to be interestingly missing, as if there is now something backward about just playing Mahler 9 for an audience that sits there in silence. So I want to say that in a context where things are being streamed and people are making remixes and people are tweeting their reactions during a performance and these are being projected on the screen, this gives you the perfect opportunity, and maybe, Joe, this is an example of something new in online marketing. You use all of these tools to say that in 2 weeks, you are going to do a performance of Mahler's Ninth Symphony, an extraordinarily powerful and profound work, and none of this is going to happen. There will be no tweeting. There will be no streaming. The performance will not be available for download afterward. The only way you can participate in it is to go there and listen for everything you're worth. So I think that in the world where all of this seems to be changing, it actually gives more opportunities to do what we've all traditionally been best at and to reaffirm its meaning and to make that meaning all the more special. Because remember, things do not in our world go in straight lines. Just for example, the resurgence of the harpsichord in the last 60, 70 years of classical music practice, one would have believed at one time it was superseded, but not at all. It turns out to be its own thing. So it may be that in the glorious and unpredictable and tumultuous digital world, silent, rapt listening becomes all the more valuable, just as, you know, in pop music, the whole notion of acoustic performance became all the more powerful the more electronics were used in standard pop releases.
It's really interesting because I think a lot of people worry that we might have two, at some point we might have two different kinds of audiences. We might have the new upcoming group of people who want to use technology and a group of older people who simply just don't want to be involved in any of this and just want to come to a concert. And could potentially be off-put by changing the way we present what the LSO is referred to sometimes as the church service, where it's the same performance, we've always done it this way, and the old guard don't want it and they would be put off from coming. I think, is that what people feel? We have some nods.
Well, I believe it too. I've never in any of my work, in any data I've seen anecdotally or in actual numbers, I've never seen any evidence that this is not true. And I've done some work with major American orchestras just creating conversations among members of the audience, and their love of the art form in its traditional manner is really strong. And you don't want to mess with that. It would be just a whole bunch of things. It would be discourteous. It would be financial disaster in the short and medium run. So I think that we're put in a really tricky position where we have to keep on doing the old things and do new things at the same time. I know that American classical music institutions are by and large not equipped to do both at once. They just don't have the resources. And they're severely strapped by this necessity, which they understand. One way it's been coming out a lot in the press is at the Metropolitan Opera, they're doing performances, productions of a kind that are very common in Europe, Regietheater, as it's called in theater, as it's called in Germany, but are not liked very much by the traditional opera audience in the United States. And Peter Gelbel runs the Met, is very firm in saying that in the future, audiences are going to demand to see other than something other than the tradition, even with traditional works. So he's just forging ahead, and the controversy seems to be selling a lot of tickets just by itself. So in a way, it's working. I am sure that many of you there have thoughts and questions and maybe even violent objections. I have to say that if I were there with you in the room, I would do what I do in my classes, which is just descend on one of you. No student is allowed not to speak in my classes. I descend on them with the biggest smile and ask them what they're saying, what they're thinking. So if there's anybody in this category here who has something that you just didn't think to say or you don't want to ruffle me, please, I would love to hear it.
Hi, I'm Chris Wheeler from Orchestra of the Swan.
Hi.
Sorry. Hi there. Just a quick question.
Hi, Chris.
It's a common held belief that if you don't get someone to a classical concert by the time they're 11 years of age, they'll never go to one. So, what is the way, do you reckon, to get young people to turn up to concerts?
I don't really believe this. I've done some research which has discovered something really amazing that just has been forgotten in the American classical music world, although the historical data, anecdotally and in terms of studies done in past generations, is absolutely unambiguous. And that's that the classical music audience in the U.S. used to be dramatically younger than it is now. Median age in its 30s, if you go back to studies I've seen done in the 1930s and the 1950s, and even the middle 1960s. And at that time, there was really no problem with somebody in their teens or their 20s just deciding to go to a classical concert because it was in the air, it was in the culture, it was really central. Now, I think, we see younger people not going. We see a pattern. Not enough has been studied about this, but I do know people in marketing who say that the standard audience for an American classical music institution, the most loyal people, the subscribers, have been going since they were young, which now may mean for 30 or 40 years unbroken. And it's harder and harder as time goes by, and there's a lot of data statistically about this, to get new people to go. So in this climate now, Chris, this is how I understand it, we get the idea, my good God, people in their 20s, 30s, even their 40s, speaking of the US, I can't say how it is where you are just not going, and we can't figure out how to get them to go, so we better get them when they're young. But now I would like to see the evidence that shows that people can be brought in. I'm sure that people could be made more familiar with classical music. I don't think that that's, you know, disputable. If it was taught in schools, they would be. How that's going to happen, by the way, I don't know. How these programs, if we define the problem of a society that doesn't care enough about classical music, why that society is going to turn around and suddenly institute classical music education in its schools, I don't quite see how that works, but supposing it happens. Now we have people learning about classical music, and I'm sure they would enjoy it. Then, here's what I think is the catch. They grow up. They get older. They become part of mainstream culture now, and they start expecting what they see everywhere else. They start expecting if you go to a concert, people talk to you. They say, hi, how are you? Here's the song I just wrote. Here are some things about it that I really care about. They may expect to be able to eat and drink during concerts. They expect to be able to participate. They come into the classical music world as we know it now, and none of these things happen. They also can happen on an individual basis. Now they go to a concert, everybody's older than them. So it's becoming from another culture. So I wonder, Chris, if it sticks, you know, that you could have childhood education in this. And then as they grow up and become the way people of their generation are, they don't see that reflected in the classical music world, and maybe most of all, the culture I think that we have, at least in the US, is a culture so much about past times that as you come to a concert and the issues that you may see discussed implicitly by the nature of the music and explicitly offered in program notes are what Schumann was thinking when he wrote a symphony in the wake of Beethoven. I think people in our culture are used to going to things and finding out what's going on now. One of the examples I've often used is the extraordinary TV series The Wire, which was originated in America. And I know it's played in the UK, and I know there have been discussions about how subtitles are needed, just as we sometimes feel if there's a movie set in Scotland among working class Scots people, because a lot of the action took place on the streets of Baltimore, a lot of street talk, and if even people in America have trouble understanding that. Anyway, it dealt primarily with police and drug dealers in Baltimore, but the producer of it said that his goal was to systematically explore the failure of American institutions, the police, the press, politics, labor unions, and I can guarantee you that the series does that unforgettably with a level of intellect and artistry you don't usually find. And with stuff like that floating around in the culture, people, why are people going to flock to classical music to meditate on what Schumann thought about Beethoven? It seems to me that we have to kind of radically reorient ourselves to the present day if we want to capture present generations. I don't at all mean, by the way, that music from the past has no role. I mean, obviously, we're reading Jane Austen, we're reading Dostoevsky, we're looking at paintings by Rembrandt and, you know, any painter you want to name from the past. So the music from the past has to take its place, but I think in a context of the present. And simply going in and educating younger people in our classical music culture may not mean that they participate when they go older. One little cautionary note, El Sistema in Venezuela, which is such an amazing success there, to my knowledge, there is no contemporary music in it. There are no composers. They don't train composers. So they are really teaching people the culture of the past. And in Venezuela, it may take root in some way. I can't speak to that. But I wonder about Britain and the U.S. Does that make sense, Chris?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
And by the way, what is Orchestra Swan? Your name, or Swan Orchestra, your name struck me. I had never heard of it.
We're based in Strathclyde.
Oh, okay. I got it.
So we have, like, we got the RSC down the road, which, depending, you know, as all sorts of age groups can see Shakespeare, which is even older than half the music we play.
Well, makes sense. And does it work?
Yeah. Very much so.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Yeah, we have one more question for you.
Okay.
Hi there, Greg. David Stark from the RSNO here.
Hey.
It's about the thinking about the Hamlet question and whether we can have Hamlet broken up. I lost my iPod a few weeks ago, and when I've been in the car, I haven't had it. I played it on the radio through one of these gadgets.
Yeah.
But I've now been forced to listen to cassette tape, because that's all there is in the car.
Right.
And I don't have any tapes anymore. There was just one in the glove compartment. So over the last few weeks, I've only had one album to listen to. And I found it quite a discipline listening to it in sequential order from side A, turning over, side B, and right through. And it struck me that it's a discipline that I've lost. And that I wonder if in the days of iPods and Shuffle and YouTube and just where we have so much culture on instant access, but equally we can instantly turn it off, whether we are losing the discipline to sit and take in a performance that lasts an hour and a half, and that in time, maybe not tomorrow, but in a generation's time, just the concept of a whole concert performance on a platform will just be a stretch too far for too many people.
Well, this is often said. By the way, I'm sorry that you lost your iPod, and I envy you. I envy you what you had to do, because I remember the days not just of cassettes but of LPs, in which an album would be planned. with a side A and a side B. Very important what you end side A with, very important what you begin side B with. It was just fascinating absorption in listening. I suspect the answer is not either or, but both and that all kinds of listening and participation will coexist together. I would love to have data about this, but a couple of things strike me. One is that very long movies are not uncommon now, and people simply sit and they watch them. Now then, of course, we get into a question of whether visual distraction is necessary to pay attention, and that's a different question, though maybe related. But the fact is that people will sit through the 2 hours, and I think it was 42 minutes, of Quentin Tarantino's film Inglourious Basterds, which maybe not for every taste, but I thought was a great masterpiece. But a very popular film in America, and people sat through it without needing to get up and have it broken up. The other thing I think about, I'm sorry, yeah. Did you want to say something?
Okay. No, I was agreeing with you.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I think of is one of the TV shows I'm addicted to, Project Runway, where fashion designers on every show are given a day or sometimes a day and a half to design, make, and fit a garment on their models. And you can't do that if you need to break every 10 minutes. It's just not possible. The amount of disciplined, concentrated work that they have to do to make this happen is just staggering. And there seems to be no shortage of people working in that field who want to be on the show. And then we get younger people, you know, who are very famous for designing video games and, by the way, playing video games, which takes a great deal of concentration, designing websites. I don't know that sustained concentration is dead. The question would be, why would somebody want to listen to a classical instrumental piece that lasted for 20 minutes to an hour? And I'm not saying that there is no reason. I'm saying maybe the reason hasn't occurred to them, so that we may be able to help them with that. And I think we're going to find them doing it. But I suspect, again, it's like the survival of the harpsichord in the age of not just grand pianos, but digital keyboards of every sort. All these things are likely to coexist.
Thank you.
I think we ought to move on with our meeting now. So I think we would like to say thanks, Greg, thanks for your time. We had fun trying to get this to work. So
it did work.
It did work all the way through without any technical hitches. So thank you very much.
Thank you all. Thanks.
So I'll cut you off now.
Okay.